Random House Audio presents Speaking from Among the Bones, a Flavia DeLuce novel by Alan Bradley, read for you by Jane Entwistle. Now from yon black and funeral yew that bays the charnel house with dew, methinks I hear a voice begin. Ye ravens, cease your croaking din. Ye tolling clocks, no time resound o'er the long lake and midnight ground. It sends a peal of hollow groans, thus speaking from among the bones. Thomas Parnell, A Night Piece on Death, 1721. Chapter 1. Blood dripped from the neck of the severed head and fell in a drizzle of red raindrops, clotting into a ruby pool upon the black and white tiles. The face wore a grimace of surprise, as if the man had died in the middle of a scream. His teeth, each clearly divided from its neighbor by a black line, were bared in a horrible, silent scream. I couldn't take my eyes off the thing. The woman who proudly held the gaping head at arm's length by its curly blue-black hair was wearing a scarlet dress, almost, but not quite, the color of the dead man's blood. To one side, a servant with downcast eyes held the platter upon which she had carried the head into the room. Seated on a wooden throne, a matron in a saffron dress leaned forward in square-jawed pleasure, her hands clenched into fists on the arms of her chair as she took a good look at the grisly trophy. Her name was Herodias, and she was the wife of the king. The younger woman, the one clutching the head, was, at least, according to the historian Flavius Josephus, named Salome. She was the stepdaughter of the king, whose name was Herod, and Herodias was her mother. The detached head, of course, belonged to John the Baptist. I remembered hearing the whole sordid story not more than a month ago when Father read aloud the second lesson from the back of the great carved wooden eagle which served as the lectern at St. Tancred's. On that winter morning, I had gazed up, transfixed, just as I was gazing now, at the stained glass window in which this fascinating scene was depicted. Later, during his sermon, the vicar had explained that in Old Testament times, our blood was thought to contain our lives. Of course! Blood! Why hadn't I thought of it before? Feely, I said, tugging at her sleeve. I have to go home. My sister ignored me. She peered closely at the music book, as in the dusky shadows of the fading light, her fingers flew like white birds over the keys of the organ. Mendelssohn's Wie groß ist des Allmacht gen Guter. How great are the works of the Almighty, she told me it meant. Easter was now less than a week away, and Feely was trying to whip the piece into shape for her official debut as organist of St. Tancred's. The flighty Mr. Callicutt, who held the post only since last summer, had vanished suddenly from our village without explanation, and Feely had been asked to step into his shoes. St. Tancred's went through organists like a python goes through white mice. Years ago, there had been Mr. Taggart, then Mr. Denning. It was now Mr. Callicutt's kick at the cat. Feely, I said, it's important. There's something I have to do. Feely jabbed one of the ivory coupling buttons with her thumb, and the organ gave out a roar. I loved this part of the piece, the point where it leaps in an instant from sounding like a quiet sea at sunset to the snarl of a jungle animal. When it comes to organ music, loud is good, at least to my way of thinking. I tucked my knees up under my chin and huddled back into the corner of the choir stall. It was obvious that Feely was going to slog her way through to the end, come hell or high water, and I would simply have to wait it out. I looked at my surroundings, but there wasn't much to see. In the feeble glow of the single bulb above the music rack, Feely and I might as well have been castaways on a tiny raft of light in a sea of darkness. By twisting my neck and tilting my head back like a hanged man, I could just make out the head of St. Tancred, which was carved in English oak at the end of a hammer beam in the roof of the nave. In the weird evening light, he had the look of a man with his nose pressed flat against a window, peering in from the cold to a cozy room with a cheery fire burning on the hearth. I gave him a respectful bob of my head, even though I knew he couldn't see me, since his bones were mouldering away in the crypt below. But better safe than sorry. Above my head, on the far side of the chancel, John the Baptist and his murderers had now faded out almost completely. Twilight came quickly in these cloudy days of March, and viewed from inside the church, the windows of St. Tancred's could change from a rich tapestry of glorious colors to a muddy blackness in less time than it would take you to rattle off one of the longer psalms. To tell the truth, I'd have rather been at home in my chemical laboratory than sitting here in the near darkness of a drafty old church, but Father had insisted. Even though Feely was 6 years older than me, Father refused to let her go alone to the church for her almost nightly rehearsals and choir practices.
"A lot of strangers likely to be about these days," he said, referring to the team of archaeologists who would soon be arriving in Bishop's Lacey to dig up the bones of our patron saint. How I was to defend Feely against the attacks of these savage scholars, Father had not bothered to mention. But I knew there was more to it than that. In the recent past, there had been a number of murders in Bishop's Lacey. Fascinating murders, in which I had rendered my assistance to Inspector Hewitt of the Hindley Constabulary. In my mind, I ticked off the victims on my fingers. Horace Bonepenny, Rupert Pawson, Brookie Harewood, Phyllis Wyvern. One more corpse and I'd have a full hand. Each of them had come to a sticky end in our village, and I knew that Father was uneasy.
"It isn't right, Ophelia," he said, for a girl your age to be rattling about alone in an old church at night."
"There's nobody there but the dead," Feely had laughed, perhaps a little too gaily. "And they don't bother me, not nearly so much as the living." Behind Father's back, my other sister, Daffy, had licked her wrist and wetted down her hair on both sides of an imaginary part in the middle of her head, like a cat washing its face. She was poking fun at Ned Cropper, the potboy at the 13 Drakes, who had the most awful crush on Feely and sometimes followed her about like a bad smell. Feely had scratched her ear to indicate she had understood Daffy's miming. It was one of those silent signals that fly among sisters like semaphore messages from ship to ship, indecipherable to anyone who doesn't know the code. Even if Father had seen the gesture, he would not have understood its meaning. Father's code book was in a far different language from ours.
"Still," Father had said, "if you're coming or going after dark, you are to take Flavia with you. It won't hurt her to learn a few hymns."
"Learn a few hymns, indeed. Just a couple of months ago, when I was confined to bed during the Christmas holidays, Mrs. Mullet, in giggling whispers and hushed pledges of secrecy, had taught me a couple of new ones. I never tired of bellowing, 'Hark, the herald angels sing, Beecham's pills are just the thing. Peace on earth and mercy mild, two for a man and one for a child.' Either that or, 'We three kings of Leicester Square, selling ladies' underwear, so fantastic, no elastic, only tuppence a pair.'" Until Feely flung a copy of Hymns Ancient and Modern at my head. One thing I have learned about organists is that they have absolutely no sense of humor. "Feely," I said, "I'm freezing." I shivered and buttoned up my cardigan. It was bitterly cold in the church at night. The choir had left an hour ago, and without their warm bodies round me, shoulder to shoulder like singing sardines, it seemed even colder still. But Feely was submerged in Mendelssohn. I might as well have been talking to the moon.
Suddenly the organ gave out a fluttering gasp as if it had choked on something, and the music gargled to a stop.
Oh, fiddle, Feely said.
It was as close to swearing as she ever came, at least in church. My sister was a pious fraud. She stood up on the pedals and waddled her way off the organ bench, making a harsh mooing of bass notes.
Now what?
She said, rolling up her eyes as if an answer were expected from above.
This stupid thing has been misbehaving for weeks. It must be the damp weather.
I think it died, I told her. You probably broke it.
Hand me the torch, she said after a long moment. We'll have a look.
We?
Whenever Feely was frightened out of her wits, I became we as quick as a flash. Since the organ at St. Tancred's was listed by the Royal College of Organists as a historic instrument, any damage to the dear old thing would probably be considered an act of national vandalism. I knew that Feely was already dreading having to break the bad news to the vicar.
Lead on, O guilty one, I said. How do we get at the guts? This way, Feely answered,
quickly sliding open a concealed panel in the carved woodwork beside the organ console. I hadn't even time to see how the trick was done. Switching on the torch, she ducked through the narrow opening and vanished into the darkness. I took a deep breath and followed. We were in a musty Aladdin's cave, hemmed in on all sides by stalagmites. In the sweep of the torch's beam, organ pipes towered above us. Pipes of wood, pipes of metal, pipes of all sizes. Some were as small as pencils, some like drain spouts, and others as large as telephone posts. Not so much a cave, I decided, as a forest of giant flutes.
What are those? I asked, pointing to a row of tall, conical pipes which reminded me of pygmy blowguns.
The Gemshorn stop, Feely said. They're supposed to sound like an ancient flute made from a ram's horn.
And these?
The roar floater.
Because it roars?
Feely rolled her eyes.
Roar floater means chimney flute in German. The pipes are shaped like chimneys.
And sure enough, they were. They wouldn't have been out of place among the chimney pots of Buckshaw.
Something hissed suddenly and gurgled in the shadows, and I threw my arm around Feely's waist.
What's that?
I whispered.
The wind chest, she said, aiming the torch at the far corner.
Sure enough, in the shadows, a huge leather trunk-like thing was slowly exhaling with various bronchial wheezings and hissings.
Super, I said. It's like a giant's accordion.
Stop saying super, Feely said. You know Father doesn't like it.
I ignored her, and threading my way among some of the smaller pipes, hauled myself up onto the top of the wind chest, which gave out a remarkably realistic rude noise, and sank a little more.
I sneezed, once, twice, three times in the cloud of dust I had stirred up.
Flavia, come down at once. You're going to rip that old leather.
I got to my feet and stood up to my full height of 4'10" and 1/4". I'm quite tall for my age, which is almost 12.
Yaroo! I shouted, waggling my arms to keep my balance. I'm the king of the castle. Flavia, come down this instant, or I'm telling Father.
Look, Feely, I said, there's an old tombstone up here.
I know. It's to add weight to the wind chest. Now get down here and be careful.
I brushed away the dust with my hands.
Hezekiah Whitefleet, I read aloud. 1679 to 1778.
Phew, 99. I wonder who he was. I'm switching off the torch now. You'll be alone in the dark.
All right, I said. I'm coming. No need to get owly.
As I shifted my weight from foot to foot, the wind chest rocked and subsided a little more,
so that I felt as if I was standing on the deck of a swamped ship. Something fluttered just to the right of Feely's face, and she froze. "Probably just a bat," I said. Feely gave a shriek, dropped the torch, and vanished. Bats were high on the list of things that turned my sister's brain to suet pudding. A further fluttering, as if the thing were confirming its presence. Picking my way gingerly down from my perch, I retrieved the torch and dragged it along the rank of pipes like a stick on a picket fence. A furious leathery flapping echoed in the chamber. "It's all right, Feely," I called out. "It is a bat, and it's stuck in a pipe." I popped out through the hatch into the chancel. Feely was standing there in an angled beam of moonlight, as white as an alabaster statue, her arms wrapped round herself. "Maybe we can smoke it out," I said. "Got a cigarette?" I was being facetious, of course. Feely was death on smoking. "Maybe we can coax it out," I suggested helpfully. "What do bats eat?" "Insects," Feely said blankly, as if she were struggling awake from a paralyzing dream. "So that's no use. What are we going to do?" "Which pipe is it in?" I asked. "Did you happen to notice?"
"The 16-foot diapason," she said shakily. "The D."
"I have an idea," I said. "Why don't you play Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, full throttle? That ought to fix the little sod."
"You're disgusting," Feely said. "I'll tell Mr. Haskins about the bat tomorrow."
Mr. Haskins was the sexton at St. Tancred's, who was expected to deal with everything from grave digging to brass polishing. "How do you suppose it got into the church? The bat, I mean." We were walking home between the hedgerows. Scrappy clouds scudded across the moon, and a raw crosswind blew and tugged at our coats.
"I don't know, and I don't want to talk about bats," Feely said.
"Actually, I was just making conversation. I knew that bats didn't come in through open doors. There were enough of the things hanging in the attics at Buckshaw for me to know that they generally got in through broken windows or were dragged in, injured, by cats. Since St. Tancred's didn't have a cat, the answer seemed obvious." "Why are they opening his tomb?" I asked, changing the subject. Feely would know I was referring to the saint.
"St. Tancred? Because it's the quincentennial of his death."
"The what?"
"Quincentennial. It means 500 years.
I let out a whistle.
"St. Tancred's been dead 500 years. That's 5 times longer than old Hezekiah Whitefleet lived."
Feely said nothing. "That means he died in 1451, I said, making a quick mental subtraction. "What do you suppose he's going to look like when they dig him up?"
"Who knows?" Feely said. "Some saints remain forever uncorrupted. Their complexions are still as soft and peachy as a baby's bottom, and they have a smell of flowers about them. The odor of sanctity, it's called."
When she felt like it, my sister could be downright chatty.
"Super colossal," I said. "I hope I get a good squint at him when they drag him out of his box." "Forget about St. Tancred," Feely said. "You won't be allowed anywhere near him." "It's like eating cooked meat," Mrs. Mullet said.
What she meant, of course, was eating cooked heat. I stared doubtfully at the bowl of squash and parsnip soup as she put it on the table in front of me. Black peppercorns floated in the stuff like pellets of used birdshot. "Looks almost good enough to eat," I remarked pleasantly. Sticking a finger into The Mysteries of Udolpho to mark her place, Daffy shot me one of her paralyzing looks.
"Ungrateful little wretch," she muttered.
"Daphne," Father said.
"Well, she is," Daffy went on. "Mrs. Mullet's soup is nothing to joke about."
Feely quickly clapped a napkin to her lips to stifle a smile, and I saw another of those silent messages wing its way between my sisters.
Ophelia, Father said.
He had not missed it either.
Oh, it's nothing, Colonel Deluce, Mrs. Mallet said. Miss Flavia asked to have a little joke. Me and her has an understanding. She means no harm.
This was news to me, but I trotted out a warm smile.
It's all right, Mrs. M, I told her. They know not what they do.
Very deliberately, Father closed the latest issue of the London Philatelist, which he had been reading, picked it up, and left the room. A few moments later, I heard his study door closing quietly.
Now you've done it, Feely said.
Father's money problems had become more pressing with each passing month. There had been a time when his worries made him merely glum, but recently I had detected something which I feared was far, far worse. Surrender. Surrender in a man who had survived a prisoner of war camp was almost unthinkable, and I realized with a sudden twinge in my heart that the bone-dried little men of His Majesty's Board of Inland Revenue had done to Father what the Empire of Japan had failed to do. They had caused him to give up hope. Our mother, Harriet, to whom Buckshaw had been left by her great uncle Tarquin Deluce, had died in a mountaineering accident in the Himalayas when I was a year old. Because she had left no will, His Majesty's vultures had descended upon Father at once and had been busily pecking out his liver ever since. It had been a long struggle. From time to time, it had looked as if circumstances might take a turn for the better, but recently I had noticed that Father was tiring. On several occasions, he had warned us that he might have to give up Buckshaw, but somehow he had always muddled through. Now, it seemed as if he no longer cared.
How I love the dear old place. The very thought of its wilting wallpaper and crumbling carpets was enough to give me goose flesh.
Uncle Tar's first-rate chemistry lab upstairs in the unheated east wing was the only part of the house that would pass inspection. But it had long been abandoned to the dust and the cold of neglect, until I had discovered the forgotten room and commandeered it for my own. Although Uncle Tar had been dead for more than 20 years, the laboratory which his indulgent father had built for him had been so far in advance of its time that it would even now, in 1951, be considered a marvel of science. From the gleaming brass of the light's binocular microscope to the rank upon rank of bottled chemicals, from the forest of flasks and flagons to the gas chromatograph which he had caused to be built, based upon the work of the enviably named Mikhail Semenovich Sweet, Uncle Tar's laboratory was now mine, a world of glass and wonder. It was rumored that at the time of his death, Uncle Tar had been at work upon the first order decomposition of nitrogen pentoxide. If those whispers were true, he was one of the pioneers of what we have recently come to call the bomb. From Uncle Tar's library and his detailed notebooks, I had managed to turn myself into a cracking good chemist. Although my interests were not so much given over to the splitting of atoms as to the concocting of poisons. To me, a jolly good dose of potassium cyanide beat stupid old spinning electrons any day of the week. The thought of my waiting laboratory was impossible to resist.
Don't bother getting up, I said to Daffy and Feely, who stared at me as if I had sprouted a second head.
I walked from the room in utter silence. Chapter 2. Viewed through a microscope at low power, human blood looks at first like an aerial view of the College of Cardinals, dressed in their scarlet berettas and capes, milling about in Vatican Square, waiting for the Pope to appear on the balcony. Not that they have to, of course. But as the magnification is increased, the color fades, until at last, when we are looking at the individual red corpuscles in close-up, we see that, in reality, each one has no more than a pale pink tint. Blood's red coloration comes from the iron contained in the hemoglobin. The iron bonds easily with oxygen, which it carries to the most far-flung nooks and crannies of our bodies. Lobsters, snails, crabs, clams, squids, slugs, and members of the European royal families, by contrast, have blue blood, due to the fact that it's based on copper rather than iron. I suppose it was finding the dead frog that had given me the idea in the first place. The poor thing had probably been trying to make its way from the river that ran behind St. Tancred's to the small marsh across the road, when it experienced a major misadventure with a motor car. Whatever the case, the thing had been squashed flat even before I stuffed it into my pocket and brought it home for scientific purposes. In order to make the corpuscles more transparent under the microscope, I had mixed a sample of its blood with a 1-in-4 solution of acetic acid. Then, as I adjusted the fine focus, I could see clearly that the frog's corpuscles were flat discs, rather like pink pennies, while my own, which I had extracted with a quick jab of a safety pin, were twice the size, and concave, like dozens of red donuts. The idea of comparing my own blood to that of my father and sisters had come later, and indirectly from Daffy.
"You're no more a Deluse than the man in the moon," she had snapped when she caught me snooping in her diary. "Your mother was a Transylvanian. You have bat's blood in your veins."
As she snatched the leather-bound book from my hand, she gave herself a rather bad paper cut with the edge of one of its pages.
"Now look what you've made me do," she'd shrieked, holding out for my inspection her bleeding, quivering finger as it dripped spectacularly onto the drawing-room carpet.
In order to increase the dramatic effect even further, she had milked a few extra drops from the wound. And then, without another word, she dashed, half sobbing, from the room. It had been a simple matter to sponge up a good bit of the gore with my handkerchief. Father was always going on about the importance of carrying a clean honking rag, and there had been several occasions upon which I'd offered up silent praise for such excellent advice. This was another of them. I had dashed at once to my laboratory, prepared a microscope slide from the blood sample, and made several quite good sketches of my observations, colouring them neatly with a box set of professional artist pencils that Aunt Millicent had given to Feely several Christmases ago. Then, through an incredible stroke of good luck, Feely, who was uncommonly vain about her hands, ripped a hangnail at the breakfast table a few days later, and it was Flavia on the spot, which is rather a good witticism when you come to think of it.
"Watch out, you stain the table linen," I said, whisking the napkin out of her fingers and handing her a wad of woolly lint from my pocket. "I'll rinse this out in cold water before it sets."
In my laboratory, I had added another set of coloured sketches to my notebook. "The circular flattened discs of the red corpuscles," I had written, "have a tendency to stick together. They display their characteristic red color only where they are seen to overlap. Otherwise, they are the pale yellow of the western sky after an evening rain." Obtaining a sample of Father's blood had been more tricky. It wasn't until the following Monday, when he appeared at the breakfast table with a ragged little patch of toilet tissue stuck to his throat where he had cut himself shaving, that I saw a way. It was the morning after Dogger had suffered one of his awful midnight episodes, crying out every few minutes in a shockingly hoarse voice, followed by long, horrid periods of whimpering, which were even more unnerving than his screams. Dogger was Father's general factotum. His duties varied according to his capabilities. He was sometimes valet and sometimes gardener, depending upon how the winds were presently blowing in his brain. Togger and father had served together in the army, and together they had been imprisoned at Changi. It was something that they never spoke of, and what few details I knew of those ghastly years had been pried, bit by painful bit, from Mrs. Mullet and her husband Alf. In the morning, I realized that father had not slept, that he had stayed at Dogger's side until the terrors subsided. Father would never normally dream of allowing himself to be seen with lavatory paper clinging to his person, and the fact that he had done so said more about his distress than he could ever put into mere words. It had been a simple matter to retrieve the stained scrap from the refuse container in his dressing room. But I must admit that in doing so, I'd never felt more guilty in my life. "Our red and white corpuscles, father's, Feely's, Daffy's and mine," I had written in my notes, although I hardly wanted to believe it, "are identical in size, shape, density and coloration." From a battered and interestingly stained book on microscopy in Uncle Tar's library, I knew that the corpuscles of a bat's blood were approximately 25% smaller in size than those of humans. Even magnified 1,000 times, my corpuscles were identical with those of my father and my sisters, at least in appearance. I had read, in one of the popular magazines which littered our drawing room, that human blood is identical in chemical composition to the seawater from which our remote ancestors are said to have crawled. That seawater, in fact, had sometimes been used for temporary transfusions in emergency medical situations in which the real thing was not available. A French researcher and artillery officer, René Quinton, had once replaced a dog's blood with diluted seawater, and found that not only did the dog live, to a ripe old age, evidently, but that within a day or two of the experiment, the dog's body had replaced the seawater with blood. Both blood and seawater are composed primarily of sodium and chlorine, although not in the same proportions. Still, it was amusing to think that the stuff which flowed in our veins was little more than a solution of table salt. Although, to be fair, both also contain dribs and drabs of calcium, magnesium, potassium, zinc, iron, and copper. For a short time, this so-called fact had made me immensely excited, suggesting, as it did, the possibility of any number of daring experiments, some of them involving humans. But then science had set in. An extensive and carefully calibrated set of chemical tests using my own blood, I was faint for weeks, showed clearly the differences. I had demonstrated quite conclusively that what flowed in the veins of the Deluces was not seawater, but a different blend of the elements of creation. And as for Daffy's accusation of my having a Transylvanian mother, well, that was simply ludicrous. My sisters had attempted, on numerous occasions, to convince me that Harriet was not my mother, that I had been adopted, or left by the little people as a changeling, or abandoned at birth by an unknown mother who couldn't bear the thought of weeping every day at the sight of my ugly face. Somehow, it would have been much more comforting to know that my sisters and I were not of the same tribe. Bat's blood, indeed! That witch, Daffy! However, all that now remained, in order to conclude my experiment in the correct scientific manner, was to add a few first-hand notes based upon my observations of the juices of an actual bat. And I knew precisely where to find one. I would get an early start in the morning. Chapter 3. It was one of those glorious days in March when the air was so fresh that you worshipped every whiff of it, that each breath of the intoxicating stuff created such new universes in your lungs and brain, you were certain you were about to explode with sheer joy. One of those blustery days of scudding clouds and piddling showers and gumboots and wind-blown brollies that made you know you were truly alive. Somewhere, off to the east in the woods, a bird was singing, "Cuckoo, jug jug, pooeetoowitawoo." It was the first day of spring, and Mother Nature seemed to know it. Gladys squeaked with delight as we rattled through the rain. Even though she was considerably older than me, she loved a good run on a damp day as much as I did. She had been manufactured at the bicycle branch of the British Small Arms Factory in Birmingham before I was born, and had originally belonged to my mother, Harriet, who had named her L'Hirondelle, the Swallow. I had rechristened her Gladys because of her happy nature. Gladys did not usually like to get her skirts wet, but on a day such as this, with her tires singing on the wet tarmac and the wind shoving at our backs, it was no time for prissiness. Spreading my arms wide so that the flaps of my yellow Macintosh became sails, I let myself be swept along on a river of wind. "Yaroo!" I shouted to a couple of dampish cows, who looked up at me vacantly as I sped past them in the rain. In the misty green light of early morning, St. Tancred's looked like a Georgian watercolour, its tower floating eerily above the bulging churchyard, as if it were a hot air balloon casting off its moorings and bound for heaven. The only jarring note in the quiet scene was the scarlet van pulled up onto the cobbled walk which led to the front door. I recognized it at once as Mr. Haskins's, the church sexton's. Beside it, on the grass under the yews, was a gleaming black hillman, its high polish telling me that it didn't belong to anyone in Bishop's Lacey. To the west of the church, almost hidden in the mist, a blue lorry was parked over against the chapel. A couple of battered ladders and a load of filthy weathered boards protruded from its open tailboard. George Battle, I thought, the village stonemason. I skidded to a stop and leaned Gladys against the worn chest tomb of one Cassandra Cottlestone, 1685 to 1750, an exact contemporary of Johann Sebastian Bach, I noted. Sculpted in stone and sadly weathered, Cassandra lay atop her mossy tomb, her eyes closed as if she had a headache, her fingertips pressed together under her chin, and a faint, smug smile at the corners of her mouth. She did not look as if she minded too much being dead. On the base was carved, "I did die, and now do lie, at church's door, for evermore, pray for my body to sleep, and my soul to wake." I noted the two different spellings of my, and remembered that Daffy had once told me some far-fetched story about the Cottlestone tomb. What was it? My thoughts were interrupted by the sound of raised voices from the church's porch. I walked quickly across the grass and stepped inside.
"But a faculty was granted," the vicar was saying. "There can be no going back now. The work is already underway."
"Then you must stop it," said a large man in a dark suit. With his lumpy potato face and mane of white hair, he had the appearance of a dust mop dressed in its Sunday best.
"You must put a stop to it at once."
"Marmaduke," the vicar said, "the bishop has assured me on several occasions that there would be no... Oh, good morning, Flavia. You're out and about early, as it were."
The large man swiveled his head slowly and let his light-colored eyes come to rest on my face. He did not smile.
"Good morning, Vicar," I burbled.
Being overly cheery at the crack of dawn is extremely upsetting to a certain kind of person, and I knew instantly that the white-haired man was one of them.
"Lovely old morning, eh what? In spite of the rain?"
I knew I was laying it on with a trowel, but there are times when I just can't help myself.
"What?"
I added for emphasis.
"Flavia, dear," the vicar said. "How nice to see you. I expect you're looking for Mr. Haskins. It's about the floral baskets, isn't it?" "Yes, I thought as much. I believe he's up the ringing chamber, tidying the bell ropes and so forth. Mustn't have chaos for Good Friday, must we?"
"Floral baskets? The vicar was including me in some little drama of his own creation. I was honored. I had barged in at an indelicate moment, and he obviously wanted me to buzz off. The least I could do was play along. Righty-ho, then. I thought as much. Father will be ever so glad to know the lilies are all sorted out. And with that, I leapt like a young gazelle onto the first step of the tower's steep spiral staircase. Once out of sight, I trudged upward, recalling that ancient stairs in castles and churches wind in a clockwise direction as you ascend, so that an attacker climbing the stairs is forced to hold his sword in his left hand, while the defender, fighting downward, is able to use his right and usually superior hand. I turned back for a moment and made a few feints and thrusts at an imaginary Viking, or perhaps he was a Norman, or maybe a Goth. When it comes to the sackers and raiders, I am quite hopeless. "Holla!" I cried, striking a fencer's pose, my sword arm extended. "On guard and so forth!"
"Blimey, Miss Flavia," Mr. Haskins said, dropping something and putting a hand to where his heart was presumably pounding. "You gave me a fair old start."
I'm afraid I gave a small smirk of pride. It's no easy matter to startle a grave digger, especially one who, in spite of his age, was as sturdily constructed as a sailor. I suppose it was his corded arms, his knotted hands, and his bandy legs which made me think of the sea. "Sorry, Mr. Haskins," I said, as I removed my Macintosh and hung it on a handy coat hook. "I should have whistled on my way up. What's in the trunk?" An ancient and much-battered wooden chest stood open against the far wall, a length of rope snaking over its lip where the sexton had let it drop, rather guiltily, I thought.
"This lot? Not much. Bunch of rubbish, really, left over from the war."
I craned my neck to see round him. In the chest were several more lengths of rope, a folded blanket, half a pail of sand, a stirrup pump with a rotted rubber hose, a second length of India rubber hose, a rather dirt-clodded shovel, a black steel helmet with a white W on it, and a rubber mask.
"Gas mask," Mr. Haskins said, lifting the thing and holding it in the palm of his hand like Hamlet. "The ARP lads and the fire watchers had a post up here during the war. Spent a good many nights here myself. Lonesome like. Strange things I used to see."
He had my undivided attention. "Such as?"
"Oh, you know, mysterious lights floating in the churchyard and that."
Was he trying to frighten me? "You're pulling my leg, Mr. Haskins."
"Perhaps I am, miss, and perhaps I amn't."
I grabbed the grotesque goggle-eyed mask and pulled it on over my head. It stank of rubber and ancient perspiration.
"Look, I'm an octopus," I said, waggling my tentacles.
Muffled by the mask, my words came out sounding like, "My mum mockum foof." Mr. Haskins peeled the thing from my face and tossed it back into the chest.
"Kids have died playing with them things," he said. "Smothered themselves to death. They're not meant for toys."
He lowered the lid of the chest, and slamming shut the brass padlock, he pocketed the key. "You forgot the rope," I said. Giving me what I believe is called a narrow look, he dug in his pocket for the key, snapped open the hasp, and retrieved the rope from the chest. "Now what?" I asked, trying to look eager.
"You'd best run along, miss," he said. "We've work to do, and we don't need the likes of you underfoot."
"Well." Ordinarily, anyone who made such a remark to my face would go to the top of my short list for strychnine. A few grains in the victim's lunch pail, probably mixed with the mustard in his spam sandwich, which would neatly hide both the taste and the texture. But wait, hadn't he said we? Who was we? I knew, from hanging round the church, that Mr. Haskins usually worked alone. He called in a helper only when there was heavy lifting to be done. such as shifting fallen tombstones, at least the heavier ones, or burying someone who...
St. Tancred, I said, and made a dash for the door.
Hang on, Mr. Haskins protested. Don't go down there.
But his voice was already fading behind me as I clattered down the winding stairs.
St. Tancred. They were opening St. Tancred's tomb in the crypt, and they didn't want me butting in. That's why the vicar had shunted me off so abruptly. Since he had directed me straight to Mr. Haskins in the tower, it didn't make any sense. But then he hadn't really had time to think. Floral baskets, indeed. Somewhere below, they were already breaking open the tomb of St. Tancred. The vestibule, when I reached it, was empty. The vicar and the white-haired stranger had vanished. To my left was the entry to the crypt, a heavy wooden door in the Gothic style, its curved frame and arched, disapproving eyebrow of stone. I pushed it open and made my way quietly down the stairs. At the bottom, a string of small, bare electric bulbs, which had been strung temporarily from the low roof, led off in the distance toward the front of the church, their feeble yellowish gleam only making the surrounding shadows darker. I had been down here just once before, upon the occasion of a winter's evening game of hide-and-seek with the St. Tancred's Girl Guides. That, of course, had been before my dishonorable discharge from the troop. Still, even after all this time, I couldn't help thinking of Delorna Higginson and how long it had taken them to make her stop screaming and foaming at the mouth. Ahead of me now, lurking in the darkness, crouched the hulking heap of scrap metal that was the church's furnace. I edged uneasily round it, not willing to turn my back to the thing. Manufactured by Deacon and Bromwell in 1851, and shown at the Great Exhibition, this famously unpredictable monstrosity squatted in the bowels of St. Tancred's like the giant squid that attacked Captain Nemo's submarine, Nautilus, in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the tin tentacles of its ducts snaking off in all directions, its two round windows of isinglass in the cast-iron door glowing like a pair of savage red eyes. Dick Plews, the village plumber, had for years been having what the vicar called an affair of the heart with the brute, but even I knew that to be sadly optimistic. Dick was afraid of the thing, and everybody in Bishop's Lacey knew it. Sometimes, during services, especially in the long silences as we settled for the sermon, a stream of four-letter words would come drifting up through the hot air ducts, words that we all knew but pretended not to. I shuddered and moved on. On both sides of me now were bricked-up arches. Behind them, stacked like cordwood, according to Mr. Haskins, were the crumbling coffins of those villagers who had gone before us into death, including a good many defunct Deluces. I must admit that there were times when I wished I could hoist those dry, papery ancestors of mine out of their niches for a good old face-to-face. Not just to see how they compared with their darkened oil portraits which still hung at Buckshaw, but also to satisfy my private pleasure in confronting the occasional corpse. Only Dogger was aware of this unusual enthusiasm of mine, and he had assured me that it was because, in tackling the dead, the pleasure of learning outweighs the pain. Aristotle, he assured me, had shared my keenness for cadavers. Dear old Dogger, how he sets my mind at ease. Now I could hear voices. I was directly underneath the apse.
Easy, someone was saying in the gloom ahead of me. Easy now, Tommy lad.
A dark shadow leapt across the wall as if someone had switched on a torch.
Steady on, steady on. Where's Haskins with that bloody rope? Pardon my French, vicar.
The vicar was silhouetted in an open archway, his back to me. I craned my neck to peer round him. On the far wall of the small chamber, a large rectangular stone had been pried from the wall and pivoted outward. One end of it was now being supported on a wooden sawhorse, while the other still rested on the lip of the stone below. Behind the stone were visible a couple of inches of cold darkness. Four workmen, all of them strangers, except for George Battle, stood at the ready. As I moved in for a closer look, I bumped against the vicar's elbow.
"Good heavens, Flavia!" the vicar exclaimed with a start, his eyes huge in the strange light. "I almost leapt out of my skin, dear girl. I didn't know you were there. You oughtn't to be down here. Far too dangerous. If your father hears of it, he'll have my head on a platter."
St. John the Baptist flashed into my mind.
"Sorry, vicar," I said. "I didn't mean to startle you. It's just that, since St. Tancred is my namesake, I wanted to be the first to see his blessed old bones."
The vicar stared at me blankly.
"Flavia Tancreda de Luce," I reminded him, injecting a dollop of fake reverence into my voice, folding my hands modestly across my chest, and casting my eyes downward, a trick I had picked up by watching Feely at her devotions. The vicar was silent for a long moment, and then he chuckled.
"You're having a game with me," he said. "I remember distinctly officiating at your baptism. Flavia Sabina de Luce was the name we bestowed upon you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. And Flavia Sabina de Luce you shall remain until such time, of course, as you choose to change it by entering into a state of holy matrimony, like your sister Ophelia."
My jaw fell open like a bread box.
"Feely?"
"Oh dear," the vicar said. "I'm afraid I've let the cat out of the bag."
"Feely? My sister Feely? Entering into a state of holy matrimony? I could scarcely believe it. Who is it to be? Ned Cropper, the potboy from the 13 Drakes, whose idea of courtship was to leave offerings of mouldy sweets at our kitchen doorstep? Carl Pendracker, the American serviceman who wanted to show Feely the sights of St. Louis, Missouri? Carl's going to take me to watch Stan Musial knock one out of the park."
"Or was it to be Dieter Schrantz, the former German prisoner of war who had elected to stay behind in England as a farm labourer until such time as he could qualify to teach Pride and Prejudice to English schoolboys? And then, of course, there was Detective Sergeant Graves, the young policeman who always became tongue-tied and furiously red in the presence of my dopey sister." But before I could question the vicar further, Mr. Haskins, rope in hand, his torch producing weird, swaying shadows, came pushing into the already crowded space.
"Make way!
Make way!"
he muttered, and the workmen fell back, pressing themselves tightly against the walls. Rather than moving out of the chamber, I used the opportunity to squirm my way farther into it, so that by the time Mr. Haskins had fixed the rope round the outer end of the stone, I had wedged myself into the farthest corner. From here, I would have a front row seat for whatever was going to happen. I glanced across at the vicar, who seemed to have forgotten my presence. His face was strained in the light of the small, swaying bulbs. What was it that Marmaduke, the man in the dark suit, had said?
"You must stop it. You must put a stop to it at once."
It was obvious that, in spite of Marmaduke, whoever he may be, the work was going ahead. The vicar was now gnawing distractedly at his lower lip.
"Where's your friend, then?" Mr. Haskins asked suddenly, turning from his work, his words echoing oddly from the crypt's curved arches. "I thought he wanted to be here for the main event."
"Mr. Sowerby," the vicar said. "I don't know. It's most unlike him to be tardy. Perhaps we should wait a while."
"This here stone's waiting on nobody," Mr. Haskins said. "This here stone's got a mind of her own, and she's coming out whether we likes it or not."
He gave the heavy block a familiar pat, and it made a most awful groan, as if it were in pain.
"She's hanging by her toenails and no more. Besides,
Norman and Tommy need to get back to Malden Fenwick, don't you, lads? They're here to work, and work they shall.
He waved grandly toward his workers, one exceedingly tall, the other quite unremarkable. Down here, in the depths of the crypt, Mr. Haskins was the ruler of his own dark kingdom, and nobody dared raise a voice against him.
Besides, he added, this is only the wall. We won't get to the sarcophagus till we're through it. Fetch the rope, Tommy.
As Tommy worked the rope up and round an overhanging shelf of masonry, Mr. Haskins turned his attention full upon me. For an awful moment, I thought he was going to tell me to leave. But he had his audience.
Sarcophagus, he said. Sar-cough-a-gus. Now there's a rare old word for you. Bet you don't know what it means, do you, miss?
It comes from two Greek words meaning eater of flesh, I said. The ancient Greeks used to make them of a special stone brought from Athos in Turkey because it was said to consume the entire body, except the teeth, in 40 days. Although I didn't do it often, I offered up a little prayer of thanks to my sister Daffy, who had read this fascinating snippet aloud to me from one of the volumes of a Coffin Black encyclopedia in Buckshaw's library.
Aha, said Mr. Haskins, as if he had known it all along. Well, there we have it then, straight from the horse's mouth,
he said, meaning me. Before I could protest what I took to be an insult, he had given the rope a fierce tug. Nothing happened.
Lend a hand, Norman. Tommy, give the other end a nudge. See if we can swing her out.
But in spite of their hauling and pushing, the stone wouldn't budge.
Seems to be stuck fast, the vicar said.
Stuck ain't the word for it, Mr. Haskins said. Well and truly bloody.
Little pictures, Mr. Haskins, little pictures, the vicar said, putting a forefinger to his lips and giving an almost imperceptible nod in my direction.
Something jamming it up like. Let's have a decor.
Mr. Haskins dropped the end of the rope and snatched the torch away from Tommy. Holding the lamp just behind its lens, he shoved his face against the crack.
No good, he announced at last. Once more of an opening.
Here, let me, I said, taking the torch from his hands. My head's smaller than yours. I'll tell you what I can see. They were all so astonished, I think, that nobody tried to stop me. My head went easily in through the gaping crack, and like a contortionist, I maneuvered the light until it was beaming into the tomb from over my head. A cold, dank draught brushed at my face, and I wrinkled my nose at the sharp, brackish stink of ancient decay. I was looking into a small stone chamber of perhaps 7 feet long and 3 wide. The first thing I saw was a human hand, its dried fingers tightly clutching a bit of broken glass tubing. And then the face, a ghastly, inhuman mask with enormous staring, acetate eyes and a piggish rubber snout. Beneath it was a white ruffle, not quite covering the ink-black vessels of the neck and throat. Above the eyes was a shock of curly golden choir boy hair. This was most definitely not the body of Saint Tancred. I turned off the torch, withdrew my head, and turned slowly to the vicar. I believe we found Mr. Callicutt, I said. Chapter 4. It was the hair, of course, that gave it away. How many Sundays had I watched Feely galloping down the aisle for first dibs on the pew from which she would have the best view of Mr. Callicutt's golden locks? Perched on the organ bench in his white surplice, his head illuminated by the light of a morning sunbeam streaming in through stained glass, he had often seemed like a Botticelli cherub brought to life. And he knew it. I remembered the way he would toss his head and quickly run all 10 fingers through his glowing curls before making them pounce on the keys for the anthem's opening chord. Feely once told me that Mr. Corlicut reminded her of Franz Liszt. It was not so long ago, she said, that there used to be found, in the keepsake boxes of ancient ladies who were freshly dead, the remnants of reeking cigar butts that had been smoked in another century by Liszt. I had meant to have a poke through Feely's belongings to see if she were hoarding the cork tips of Mr. Corlicut's craven A's, but it had slipped my mind. All of this went whizzing through my brain as I waited for the men to enlarge the opening and confirm my discovery. Not that I wasn't shocked, of course. Had Mr. Corlicut died because I'd counted corpses on my fingers? Had he been made a victim by some dark and unsuspected magic? Stop it at once, Flavia, I scolded myself. The man was obviously dead for ages before you tempted fate to hand you another cadaver. Still, the man was dead. There was no getting round that. While part of me wanted to break down and cry at the death of Feely's golden-haired Prince Charming, another part, a part I couldn't quite explain, was awakening eagerly from a deep sleep. I was torn between revulsion and pleasure, like tasting vinegar and sugar at the same time. But pleasure, in such cases, always wins, hands down. A hidden part of me was coming back to life. Meanwhile, the workmen had brought a number of sturdy planks to lever the heavy stone forward, as well as to serve as a makeshift ramp, down which it could be manhandled to the floor.
Easy, now, easy, Mr. Haskins was telling them. Don't want to squash him, do we?
Mr. Haskins was completely at home with corpses. At last, after much grating and a couple of curses, the stone was removed and the chamber's contents became clearly visible. The gas mask strapped to the corpse's face glinted horridly, as only wet rubber can, in the shuddering light.
Oh dear, the vicar said, oh dear, I'd best ring up Constable Linnet. No great rush, I'd say, said Mr. Haskins, judging by the smell of him.
Harsh words, but true. I knew in great detail from my own chemical researches the process by which the human body, after death, digests itself, and Mr. Corlicut was well along the way. Tommy and Norman had already produced handkerchiefs and clapped them to their noses.
But before I do so, the vicar said, I would ask each of you to join with me in a short prayer for this most unfortunate individual.
We bowed our heads.
O Lord, receive the soul of this, thy faithful servant, who has come to great misfortune, alone and in a strange place.
A strange place indeed, although I didn't say so.
And perhaps also in fear, the vicar added, after taking a few moments, as if fishing for the proper words. Grant him, we beseech thee, eternal peace and the life everlasting. Amen.
Amen, I said quietly. I almost crossed myself, but I fought down the urge. Although our family patronized St. Tancred's because the vicar was one of Father's dearest friends, we de Luces, as Daffy liked to say, had been Catholics for so long that we sometimes referred to St. Peter as Uncle Pete and to the Blessed Virgin Mary as Cousin May.
Flavia, dear, the vicar said, I'd be indebted to you if you'd come up and help me deal with the authorities. You're so much better at this sort of thing than I.
It was true. There had been several occasions in the past upon which I had pointed the police in the proper direction when they were hopelessly stumped.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Richardson, I said.
For now, I'd seen all I wanted to. Outdoors, it had rained, and the vicar and I stood waiting side by side in the porch, strangely tongue-tied by what we had just witnessed. The police, when they arrived in their familiar blue Vauxhall saloon, were wearing their best poker faces. Inspector Hewitt gave me a curt nod and a fraction of a smile as he stepped from the car. Detective Sergeants Woolmer and Graves were their usual selves, Woolmer like a large and surly dancing bear. The Vauxhall groaned audibly with relief when he hoisted himself ponderously out of it, while Graves, young, blonde, and dimpled, was grinning at me ear to ear. As I have said, Sergeant Graves had a first-rate crush on Feely, and in a number of ways, I hoped he would be the one to march the divine Ophelia, ha ha, pardon me if I laugh, to the altar.
One more detective in the family would give us something to talk about during the long winter evenings, I thought. Guts, gore, and Tetley's tea.
Sergeant Woolmer gave me barely a glance as he hauled his photo kit from the car's boot. I looked away and nodded pleasantly at Sergeant Graves, who was carrying a familiar case.
Got the dabs organized, have you?
I asked pleasantly, showing him I remembered that his specialty was fingerprints. The sergeant colored nicely, even though I was merely Feely's sister. Like Santa Claus in the American poem, they spoke not a word, but went straight to their work. They filed into the porch, bound for the crypt, leaving the vicar and me standing alone together at the door.
How long has he been missing? Mr. Corlicott, I mean.
Missing?
In spite of having telephoned for the police, the vicar still seems somewhat in a daze.
We hadn't really thought of him as missing. Departed, I should say.
Oh dear, no, that's hardly the correct word either. I said nothing. A useful tool that I had added to my kit by closely observing Inspector Hewitt at his work.
Mrs. Battle said he came down that last morning for breakfast, just as he always did, a single slice of toast only.